Chapter 12. When he awoke, Adam had, forward in his mind, the memory of a certain grove of apple trees he had wanted to photograph for most of a year. He had stumbled upon them many months before while riding his bike down random roads and paths, trying to find things that had significantly changed since he had seen them last. The ground beneath the trees had been littered with fruit, and as he picked one that still clung to a branch and bit into its juicy sweetness, Adam realized he would like to shoot them when they were blooming. Today was to be a day of gathering new images, and Adam had planned to shoot his usual orthogonal subjects. Still, something about those trees had gotten under his skin, and he felt compelled to shoot them. He could swing by there first thing, and then move on to the building projects. It was early, but Emma had already left for her day of painting Sovereign. He had watched as she readied her supplies the night before and loaded them onto her bike. As was her habit, she rose at dawn to go for a long ride before heading over to the sitting. It sickened Adam that she was going back to Sovereign, but they knew of no alternative, and he trusted in her strength. It was going to be a long day. He needed a distraction. Adam stood on the porch with a cup of hot tea and looked out over the yard. It had rained hard last night, and it was cool and mostly still, with some disjointed bird songs thrilling from the forest at the edge of the yard and a mild breeze rustling the trees. He saw up the gravel road there was some mist where last night's rains were meeting this morning's sun. He thought of the apple trees again and knew that this was the perfect morning to shoot them if he didn't waste time. He set his cup on the table and hurried to get dressed and gather his equipment. Less than an hour later, he stood in the middle of a dirt road facing 24 elderly apple trees in full bloom. Behind the trees, the land gently sloped down to a small pond, and from this saturation came a mist that rolled up the hill, curled around the trunks, snaked upwards and shrouded the backmost trees in an ethereal veil. Adam arranged his tripod and Linhof so the ground glass framed the rightmost 10 trees, 5 across the foreground and then the 5 in the row behind. The trees were an explosion of blossoms with a scattered carpet of pale white petals beneath, except for the second tree from the right in the row closest to him, which was dead. Its branches, bereft of leaf and flower, were exposed in their grotesque, twisted blackness, the evidence of a past hard-won life, one cell upon another, in a growth both agonizingly slow and excruciatingly fleeting. It was jarring, the stark, angular, barren tree surrounded by those so well-rounded and bursting with life. He had seen this tree last fall, as it produced its last apples, beautiful, fat, red apples, as if the tree had pushed the last lovely remnants of its life to the tips of its already dying branches and presented to the world a beautiful treasure it would never see or appreciate. Thus was the undeniable yearning for life. He wondered why things had gone differently for this one tree, what had caused it to die before the others in its company. He examined the image on the ground glass and made minor adjustments to the standards. In the camera, the tree hung upside down, desperately stretching for the earth. Before leaving the orchard, he made his way down to the pond for a drink of water, carefully stepping through the tall, wet grass to avoid slipping down the hill. He crouched at the water's edge and stared for a long time into the still water. Like all the water in Abacus, it was supposed to be sterile. But still he looked for movement or any sign of life. There was none. Adam shook his head. Maybe he and Emma had dreamed the toad. He cupped his hand and drank. Like virtually every other person of Abacus, Adam revered the memory of John Sovereign. Most were tolerant of the irony that comes with venerating someone who had abhorred hero worship. It couldn't be helped. Sometimes people actually were heroic. John Sovereign had not believed in life at any cost, but he believed in a rich and centered life. So while everyone who had ever passed through Abacus owed him their life, many were also deeply grateful for the quality of life they enjoyed. This was felt most acutely by the generation who entered Abacus as adults, even as they understood and processed the horrors that were happening outside the thin membrane that kept them sheltered. John Sovereign had an exquisite sense of what people needed to be well and had strived to provide that in myriad ways, large and small, and he succeeded to the degree that the first generation of people born and raised in Abacus really were well and knew no other state. Of all the Sovereign programs Adam was grateful for, the building projects was perhaps his favorite. John Sovereign had scoured the world for masters of the building trades who could pass the entrance requirements, which was no small feat. He first had to convince them of the validity of the Abacus concept, and then subject them to the same rigorous screening process everyone else endured. He found skilled and innovative masons and plasterers, carpenters, timber framers, and architects who not only had mastered their craft at a young age, but who were willing and able to teach their skills to others. Every building in Abacus had been created through the knowledge of these men and women, distilled from the knowledge of the other masters who had come before them throughout all of human history, and then passed on with care and generosity to those who came after. When there was no need for a new building or major repairs to old ones, those who loved to build came to the projects, an eclectic compound of buildings in various states of construction in the dead center of Abacus, equally available to the people of all four quadrants. Here was where crafts were honed, ideas were shared, and visions were brought to life. Because there were finite materials available, older buildings might be carefully deconstructed and rebuilt in new form. There was a long, dry stone wall that had been snaking around the property for nearly 100 years. When it had become long enough to push the bounds of wastefulness, it was dismantled on the old end and extended on the new, changing direction as it went, and as a new generation of masons grew sinewy and skilled at taming stone and gravity to do their bidding. At the western edge of the projects was a modest castle of limestone. It had stood there for over 80 years, being one of the first building projects undertaken in Abacus. Adam had entered it many times throughout his life, and he was grateful it had so far escaped being cannibalized for other projects. He stood silent in a deserted hallway. There was nothing here but a stone wall, a tile floor, a dusty canvas tarp, and a door that was ajar. His forearm rested on his tripod as he stared into the empty space he found so replete with possibility. He stood for a long time, watching the light spill into the room and define the shapes it fell across. The worn, soft tarp was crumpled and folded on itself, creating a complex terrain that was echoed and elongated in shadow upon itself. Upstairs, a wall was being demolished, but Adam did not want to bring the sounds of work and conversation into the sharpness that would make them cogent. As background noise, they acted as insulation, compacting him further into himself. He didn't register the swing and smack of their sledgehammer, but he did hear detritus ticking to the floor around him and saw the bands of light define as they became thick with dust. He swung the Polaroid camera, slung from its strap at his back, around to the front, and held it to his eye, framing carefully, and released the shutter. The camera whirred and ejected a foggy photograph into his hand. Adam waited for the Polaroid to develop, gently shaking it and scrutinizing the veiled image emerging slowly before him. He glanced up into the room and realized the dust was thinning and would soon be gone. He tossed the Polaroid aside and quickly set up his large format camera. He had just enough time to pull off one shot before the moment he wished to capture was gone forever.